south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, so you found me again. Yep. It's that very un-PC, un-woke show, The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. Yep, today we've got another no-bullshit look at how expats live. Work, play, mate, date, and do business here in Latin America. As you longtime listeners know, our conversations and boots-on-the-ground stories hit on all kinds of different topics pertaining to expats. We take in all subjects. We go all over the place. We talk about the expats who are winners. They found their version of paradise. And the expat losers who end up going home with their tails between their legs for whatever reason. And if they don't go home, they're the whiners and complainers you don't want to sit next to if you're stuck with them at a party. So it's true, it's not all smiles and roses here in Latin America, but I'll tell you, if you add up the pluses and minuses, if you come on down and make it past the first 6 months or a year, you'll never regret it. By the way, consider that first 6 months or year your probation period when you've got your training wheels on. Anyway, the time will come when you'll wonder why you didn't come down ages ago. Let's just say you'll never want to go back to Cleveland. Which leads us right into this very telling email. It's from Peter S. He says, Johnny, I'm 50 now. Looking back, and I guess most people do when they hit 50, my biggest regret is that I've lived the life others wanted me to live. For example, number one, I became a lawyer because my dad's a lawyer. And he said, son, you've got to follow in my footsteps. I've paved the way for you. Number two, when I got married, I married a girl everyone else liked so much and thought I should marry because we'd be a good match. We liked each other, but in time found out we didn't have that special spark. Soon enough, we ran out of things to talk about. We did what so many other incompatible couples did. We stayed together for the kids. Number three, most of the friends I made were ones who could advance my law practice. Number four, I joined clubs and organizations for the same reasons too. Not because I wanted to, but because I could make the right connections. Number five, I went on vacations that others recommended. I would have loved to have climbed a volcano in Guatemala, for example. But my family said I was nuts and wouldn't go along with me. But now, at 50, I'm done with all that. Divorced, the kids are out of the house on their own. I feel like a college kid again. It's not a midlife crisis, it's a second wind. So, now what? Well, I'm getting my plan B going, of course. So, Johnny, when's your next seminar? Put me on the list. Signed, Peter, from East Orange, New Jersey. Peter, East Orange. I've heard that's a pretty dangerous place to live. Well, I guess any place could be safe if you got dough, right? Anyway, Peter, good for you. And it's nice that you discovered all this at age 50, and you're ready to act on it. Because I'd say most Americans who realize they've been living the life of others, they can't do anything about it because they're stuck on the treadmill. By the way, at the end of this email, Peter put down the lyrics of a famous Mamas and the Papas song. Quote, you better go where you wanna go, do what you wanna do. Remember that song? If you do, you're a boomer like me. Oh, and Pete, about that next seminar, we will be doing it in Central America again by overwhelmingly popular demand. Looks like we're going to Guatemala and El Salvador again. It'll be in the spring sometime of 23. Just keep listening and I'll keep you posted. By the way, this particular Expat Files show first comes out on Sunday, November 13th. Just to let you know, the one that's supposed to come out on Friday, the 18th, well, it'll probably be a repeat of a show because I'll be traveling in and out of the boonies and the jungle. Just to let you know. But we'll be back with a new Expat Files show starting Sunday, the 20th of November. All right, moving on. You know, a couple of shows ago, I was talking about Airbnbs here in Latin America. You know, I've stayed in quite a few of them myself. And since it seems to be a growth industry, well, till COVID hit anyway, I continuously get emails from expats and gringos wondering if they should put their excess cash to work down here, buy a property or two, and list them with Airbnb. Now, if you heard that show, you heard me list my reasons why I'm against it. Principally because the world's economy is imploding. You know that already. Inflation worldwide is exploding too. People have less dough and less purchasing power, so they're going to travel less. That means there's going to be less demand for Airbnbs too. In fact, the first thing people cut out when they're low on funds is traveling, which is a kiss of death for the Airbnb and even the hotel business in general. Anyway, since I did that show on Airbnbs, I got quite a few emails from people, Airbnb owners even, who by and large are completely agreeing with my assessment. I've also been receiving quite a few emails from people who have been unhappy about their Airbnb experiences. Like, for example, this one from Lynn. She says, "Johnny, the fees on Airbnb are insane. Personally, they're a lot more work than you think. A lot more work for me anyway, because I like to clean it after I use it. I'm sort of a detailed and fastidious person, and I don't like to leave a place trashed. Besides that, I have dogs, and I don't want Airbnb people to gang up on us dog owners." Then she says, "As much as I get more and more upset with the Airbnbs I've been at, they're also sort of a blessing for me because I travel frequently with two small dogs. And using Airbnb is about the only way I can travel with them. No hotels would ever permit it. Keep up the great shows, Johnny." Signed, Lynn. All right, Lynn, thanks for that. Just two comments here. Number one, I can see why you do a thorough cleanup upon checkout with the dogs and all. Because I can tell you, if I was an Airbnb owner and the client checked out leaving the place loaded with fur balls and dog smells, I think I'd be looking to cause a big stink myself. But you're right, I never thought about how convenient it is for people who are traveling with pets. Though I have to tell you, here in Latin America, most hotels and mom-and-pop bed and breakfasts say they won't take pets. The reality is most of them will negotiate. If you show up with a dog and they say they don't take pets, you shouldn't just say okay and walk away. You should say, "How much extra for my dog?" The fact is they'll almost always quote you a figure, and you can bargain from there. I've heard dozens of stories like that, especially if it's a cat or a small dog and you've got a cage. You offer an extra $20 a night, and that'll usually smooth out things just fine. Of course, that won't work if you've got a man-eater. Just saying. Then there's this email from Clara. She says, "Johnny, you're right. Airbnb bookings are way down. My mother has a place across from the beach in Fort Lauderdale. Her prices are pretty nominal, but she's got ridiculous cleaning fees. Airbnb owners keep jacking up those fees every year and add on additional costs, too. Plus," she says, "when people rent Airbnbs, there are lots of problems with security, since most of them are not in residential towers or gated, guarded communities where you have to check in and out your visitors, too. It's always infinitely more secure to check in with a real live guard at the front desk, but that's not the case with the majority of Airbnbs. Personally," she says, "I know all about the Airbnb business because, like I said, my mother has one. But give me a good hotel in walking distance to everything any day." You're right, Johnny. If you're getting into the Airbnb business now, it's a losing proposition. COVID washed a lot of owners out, but not nearly enough. The supply is still bigger than the demand. And the demand keeps falling. Then there's a PS here. She says, "Johnny, some of those places look great on the website. A great deal for a group of four, for example. Until you start adding in all those extra fees. $200 for cleaning, $150 service charge. Come on. Give me a nice, safe, centrally located, clean hotel where the maid comes in, cleans up, and changes your sheets daily. To me, that's the only way to go." All right, then there's this email from Harvey. He says, "Johnny, I've owned a rental cabin business in Minnesota for about 8 years now. I also have a foot in the door in Latin America. I've been down to Panama a number of times and was considering doing the Airbnb thing there too, but I've nixed that idea. Ever since in the last year or two, observing a growing number of new persons buying cabins to rent out as Airbnbs. The little known secret is that most of them last just a little over a year and then quit and try to sell. It's a very difficult business now. Bookings are down. The market is being flooded. And about those bad renters, like most everything, they follow Pareto's law. 20% of the people cause 80% of the problems. I've seen it all. Carpet and furniture spills, scratched countertops, broken appliances, water damage, clogged toilets and drains, long-standing garbage. When people don't own it, they just don't care. It's that simple. And as far as people living in a place who want to put it on Airbnb when they're away, you're so right, Johnny. You don't want to live in a place part-time, and when you're not there, rent it out as an Airbnb. You'll just cringe at the client abuse and the wear and tear. On top of that, there are some very picky people like my wife, who won't sleep on a bed that other people she doesn't know have been sleeping on. She even brings her own set of extra sheets and pillowcases when we travel. More and more people seem to be doing that these days. It's not a bad idea. Anyhow, I'm used to it." All right, Harv, thanks for that. And just one comment about security and Airbnbs. Now, I know I mentioned this quite a few years ago on the show. I had a couple of boots on the ground examples of some people in Colombia, gringos and expats, who rented Airbnbs and had been robbed or scammed. The problem is, with an Airbnb, dozens, if not hundreds of people have been in and out of that place. Depends how long it's been on the market, right? And all of those guys and gals had access to keys and were able to copy them. That goes for the maids and maintenance people, too. They've all got copies. Plus, they know all the weak points, the doors that are sloppy, the windows that aren't quite secure. Let's put it this way. For every report I've gotten from people who say they've gotten robbed or ripped off in a hotel, I've heard multiple reports of people being robbed, ripped off, or scammed at an Airbnb. Not that those things are common. They're not at all. It's just with an Airbnb, you're putting a lot of faith in the owner and the neighborhood it's in. It's location, location, location. Plus, you get what you pay for, just like with this show. But you knew that already, right? All right, now another very interesting email from Jeffrey. He says, "Hi, Johnny, hope all is well. I was driving my daughter to school the other day. I was stopped at a light with my window rolled down. A guy came running at me on the driver's side with his arm cocked back. He's yelling something about the size of my vehicle. I have a pretty big vehicle, so obviously this guy was a global warming warrior, all pissed off about what I was driving. By the way," he says, "this is quite common in Boulder, Colorado. Anyway, I moved my car through the intersection to avoid getting hit. Pulled the car over, ran over to him, and clocked him right in the face. Now, Johnny, this is not something I'd normally do, but the adrenaline and the frustration with this type of behavior obviously has been building up in me. My question is, Johnny, if the same type of situation happened in some place like Guatemala City, what would happen in the eyes of the law? Would both parties be arrested? Would the gringo be at an advantage or disadvantage? Anyway, thanks for your time. I was just curious if you had any experience with something like that. Signed, Jeffrey in Boulder." Well, Jeff, first of all, I have to say you deserve a medal for clocking the guy. I'm sure being in Boulder, you encounter extreme wokester behavior all the time. You can't beat him. Well, I guess you tried, didn't you? The only solution, of course, is get the hell out of Dodge. Though, as far as your question, could that ever happen in Guatemala? And if it did, what would happen to the gringo? Well, first of all, if that ever happened to you, it wouldn't be a Latino or Latina calling you out. It would be a woke gringo expat. And you'd most certainly be on the gringo tourist trail because that's where they congregate. They do find each other and join up in moronic fakebook groups, often seen whining and texting away on their iPhones made by Chinese slave labor over $6 Frappuccinos at the local Starbucks. Yep, that's right. Starbucks has infiltrated Latin America, with the highest concentration of them, of course, being on the gringo tourist trip. Ain't it the truth? Starbucks and wokesters, they go together like bacon and eggs, ketchup and mustard, water and chocolate, peanut butter and jelly, mac and cheese. But I digress, as usual. You get the point. So anyway, Jeff, if you ever get into a fracas like that on a Latin American street, it won't be with a local Latino because they're just not woke at all. In fact, if you happen to be driving a big old late model SUV, you'll be the envy of the neighborhood. Because remember, down here, you're deep in the land of the gringo wannabes. In fact, you know that little situation, that encounter you just described to us? If I was to sit down with the average Latin American, even the above average Latin American, and explain what had happened, it not only wouldn't sink in, they wouldn't understand at all what was going on. They'd think I was making it up. They would really think I'm trying to tell them a stupid gringo joke that I translated, and they'd be waiting for the punchline that would never come. I'm not kidding you. It really is a beautiful thing to be living in a place that's about 30 years behind all that woke, fill-in-the-blank, justice warrior lunacy. But back to the question of what would really happen if a couple of gringos got into a punch-out on a Latin American street. Probably nothing, unless one of them wanted to press charges. And if so, that means you'd both would probably be wasting a half a day at the police station. You'd have to lawyer up and stick around the country at least 6 to 8 months, because it just might take that long for you to get a court date. Then you both would probably plead self-defense, and it would be your word against his. And if there were any witnesses willing to come forward at all, and they probably wouldn't, good luck trying to shag them down 6 or 8 months later when you finally do go to court. That's why here in Latin America, people just do not like to sue. You really have to be determined, have a lot of stamina, and lots of time on your hands to ever take anyone to court. There just are no ambulance chasers down here, with the exception of Mexico. It's kind of like the California of Latin America. Every new trend, good or bad, always appears there first. Why not? It's joined at the hip to the U.S. All right, yanking the wheel here. Let's get to an email that kind of hits home for me, too, and you'll see why. This from longtime listener and long-distance friend, Commander Flash Gordo. He entitles this little tome here, quote, "In mild defense of off the gringo trail and off the cartel trail, expat living in Mexico." He says, "Hola, Johnny, from two decade-long listeners currently living in Oaxaca State in southern Mexico, and here for almost 7 years in this particular place." He says, "My wife grudgingly listens to your info-packed podcast. She says you're arrogant and overconfident." To which I say, "It ain't bragging if you can do it." She admits she always learns something useful, though. She can't deny your 3 decades of Latin American experience and your off-the-gringo tourist trail immersion into Latin American society. She says all that's got to be worth at least a donut and a cup of coffee. Anyway, first off, he says, after 7 years down here myself, with episodes both on and off the gringo tourist trail and on and off the drug cartel trail, meanwhile, every 6 months, making a run to Guatemala to get those all-important passport stamps for legal exit and entry. I've had to do all that for years, simply because I can't make the income requirement necessary to get temporary residency in Mexico. And, coincidentally, with a wife who refuses to go any further south of the border to greener pastures in places like Guatemala. She loves it here in Mexico and has made a lot of local friends. Bottom line, she's the boss, and I get it. However, on the residency front, I recently took advantage of a current bureaucratic fluke of a residency program called Regularization and got my temporary residency in Mexico. Turns out, there's a global immigration loophole for so-called displaced migrants due to in-country violence in their homelands, and especially on account of that COVIDiot plague that killed tens of billions of virtual people. Nyuk, nyuk. But seriously, there is a temporary residency loophole here in Mexico that they said will be closed in 2023. So I took advantage. Apparently, any Ukrainian applying is getting residency here almost automatically. And get this, displaced Australian journalist Max Egan got his instant residency by saying he was afraid to be vaccinated if he returned to Australia. So when asked that question myself, I said I feel far safer here in Mexico than the USA due to a criminal federal government in the States that was probably going to let us get into a nuclear war with Russia. And guess what? Surprise, surprise, the very friendly immigration officer in Mexico agreed with me. So, 4 hours later, after submitting my paperwork at the local immigration office, and with every one of my fingers crossed, I walked out with my temporary residency card in hand that leads to permanent residency in 4 years. And my wife will do the same in 3 more weeks when she applies for temporary residency, though her reason for not wanting to leave Mexico will be different than mine. Hers will be, she just might encounter that toxic Johnny Mueller whilst getting her passport stamped in Guatemala. Mexican immigration just might buy that. So, Johnny, that means our lot has been cast with Mexico, despite agreeing with you that better options exist farther south. So, after 8 years here in southern Mexico, far enough off the drug runner routes to be fairly safe, we think it's a pretty good option. Then he says, "I'd say the Oaxacan government basically shares some of the overall benefits of Latin America in general. The police presence is almost unnoticeable in daily life. The locals are extremely friendly. And out here in the countryside, the gringo advantage is still quite powerful, alive, and refreshing." Then he's got a cautionary tale. He says, "Johnny, this state, Oaxaca, is renowned for great cuisine. But as an aside, I will share that I got nailed with a nasty, somewhat antibiotic-resistant strain of Shigella, a nasty gut bacteria, probably from an infected food preparation worker. So I'm sadly permanently off fantastic-tasting street food for good." He says, "It seems I'm finally cured after 3 different powerful antibiotic courses, including a month of drinking chlorine dioxide." Wait a minute. Just a second, Flash. You mean you've been living south of the border for almost 10 years, and you're just now swearing off street food? Man, Flash, that's like the number one or number two complaint from gringos and expats and tourists in Latin America. Montezuma's revenge. You gotta know, every time you eat street food, no matter how good it tastes, you're rolling the dice with old Montezuma. Where's that willpower, Flash, huh? I bet with all that street food you pound down, you don't fit very well into that superhero suit anymore, do you? Enough said about that. Anyway, he goes on to say, "Johnny, you often warn listeners about Mexico, and rightfully so, for most of the country. But if you choose wisely here and plan to locate well off the usual tourist runs, Mexico is doable, with another possible prime choice site being Chiapas State, which borders Guatemala, and mostly well off the tourist runs, and has more water than any other Mexican state, too. And the people there have a history of resistance to the federal government. For example, during the COVIDian thing, whole villages there cast a solid middle finger to the federal government and refused to even consider a local vaccination effort. A very good sign. Then he says, lastly, Johnny, I'm curious about your take on unruly street and compo dogs and how you deal with them. Turns out country bicycle and joyriding is almost totally out here in my area due to the almost certainty you'll be chased by aggressive dogs. I'm a dog lover, he says. I walk our three rescued dogs daily out into the countryside lanes and carry a stout walking stick. And I've had to, on a few different occasions, smack a few dogs around. I had to. They were going after my dogs. In fact, here's a story for you. My friend Christine came to the rescue of her dog while walking on a dirt path down the Pacific coast. Turns out, two marauding pit bulls turned on her, pulled her down and bit her stomach and ripped the skin on her scalp. Luckily, her husband came to her rescue, but stitches were required. And listen to this. When I first arrived in Oaxaca and was exploring some of the outlying barrios of the capital city, I came upon a pack of over 40 dogs. They were quite menacing, and I turned sideways to the pack leaders, as you're supposed to do, and slowly backed out of there. I got out all right, but it could have been bad. Anyway, Johnny, any thoughts on a strategy for evil street dogs? What I'm saying is, if you live in the campo, meaning the outskirts or the boonies, though the living is generally great, there are certain things you have to put up with and get used to, like the dogs. Then he closes out by saying, Johnny, thanks for all you contribute to us expats looking for the good life south of the border. Seems like these days anywhere south of the border is freer with a lot more promise than the USSA. He says, while I love my fellow USA countrymen and the culture, the federal government is clearly well off the rails and out of control. I don't want to be part of a dying empire. My advice, I would encourage anyone torn by indecision to get that plan B going. Be an expat. Because that fence you're sitting on is rapidly turning into a razor blade. Time is running out for you. He signs off by saying, best wishes from me, but not my wife. Signed, Commander Flash Gordo. Well, thanks for that rant, Commander Flash. A lot of good stuff there. But somehow, I don't think you're going to get that Marvel movie deal. Of course, it does depend on how you look in that spandex suit. Now, about that dog thing, get a lot of emails about that. Though, I have to tell you, in all my time through Guatemala, Panama, El Salvador, Honduras, you know, south of the border. Sure, you've got street dogs, but you mostly see them in really crappy barrios. You almost never see them in business districts or nicer neighborhoods. Not in packs or groups, anyway. And even when they're in the barrios, at least south of the border, that is, south of Mexico, when you're walking towards them, they usually scatter. They're not aggressive. Though, I have to tell you, a couple of times I've run into some cemetery dogs. You know, there are dogs that hang around the cemetery. And Latinos, you know, they love to visit cemeteries. And the dogs there can be aggressive. But let's talk about, for a second, dogs that really get on your nerves. Dogs that might be digging through your garbage because you're living out in the boonies. And, you know, you've got a trash barrel outside, maybe a place where you burn leaves and scrap and stuff. So they do like to come around. Just a warning. About the only time I see street dogs getting nasty is when you've got your dog with you. Normally, they don't mess with humans. Not that I've seen. And I'm almost always south of the border. Now, very much related to this is the fact that I power walk almost every day for an hour or so, and I always carry an umbrella. Not a full-size one. Those are too bulky and inconvenient. I carry a mini or small telescoping umbrella. And since I've been doing this for years now, there have been a couple cases when I wish I had a billy club instead of an umbrella. You know, just something really hefty in your hand in case you really had to take a swing at something like a dog or a guy in the back of a motorcycle intent on getting your cell phone. That's why if you heard my show, I think it was about 8 months ago or so, I told you that I bought a self-defense umbrella, a mini telescoping one. You know, telescoping umbrellas are very convenient. They're 12 inches or less when they're collapsed. So anyway, the normal ones that are halfway decent, they're between 15 and 30 bucks. They're light as a feather and not a defense against anything. So when I saw there was a brand new type of self-defense umbrella, a telescoping umbrella, it was 250 bucks. But I thought, hell, it's really like an insurance policy. So I bought it. Now, it looked absolutely like a normal mini umbrella, but felt like a billy club in my hand. Man, it felt good, and it made you feel secure and confident. But wouldn't you know it, within 3 weeks, I lost it somewhere. 250 bucks. Down the crapper. Stupid move. Why didn't I know that was going to happen? I've lost many umbrellas before. no big deal when your umbrella's worth 15 or 20 bucks. When it's worth 250, man, you want to cry. That was a couple of months ago. And all the while, every day, I've been walking and thinking, necessity is the mother of invention. And suddenly, I had an idea for a brand new kind of self-defense product. Something that can turn any telescoping mini umbrella into a super effective self-defense umbrella. So I drew it up and had some indigenous ladies make me a few prototypes. What I'm saying is use your own umbrella. It's a sheath that goes over your umbrella. So anyway, when you're walking around and it's not raining, it looks exactly like any other old folded up or collapsed mini umbrella. Except there's something very special about it. And nope, it's not made of any kind of metal. It's not heavy. It's only something like 3 ounces. Your mini umbrella itself weighs 5 times as much. There's nothing pointed or sharp about it either. I've made up a couple dozen of them. I have some people out there testing them, both men and women who do a lot of walking around. And the people who have them now are giving me great reports. They're telling me it gives them a sense of security and confidence they never had before whilst walking around. So anyway, I'll let you know when the thing gets on the market. It'll probably take a few months yet. I'm working out the suppliers for the secret ingredients. By the way, I've got a couple of indigenous ladies sewing and assembling these things. Jobs for the locals, right? Now remember, what I'm telling you is this is an add-on for whatever umbrella, collapsible or telescoping umbrella you want to use. And it's virtually indistinguishable from the umbrella sheet that comes with every umbrella, you know. Every one of them comes with a little fabric sleeve you slip over it for when it's not in use, right? However, this is a brand new idea, a different kind of sheath that slips right over your existing telescoping or mini umbrella. By the way, when it starts raining and you have to use your umbrella, you have to take the thing off. It folds down to a very small size and fits in any pocket. Oh, and I guess you're wondering, how does it stack up against that $250 defense umbrella that I lost? This little add-on sheath that'll probably sell for 29 bucks is better, more convenient, more reliable, and functional in all ways than that $250 job. Remember, I'm the guy who walks around in Latin America at least an hour a day. And sometimes, you know, when you see a few street dogs, you need a little confidence booster. And even if you never have to use it, and you probably won't, believe me, once you've tried it, I don't care what city, state, or country you live in, you won't leave home without it. Now, I'm not trying to be a salesman here. I don't care who invented this thing. I think every expat should have one of these. And anyone who's basically out and about and walking around a lot. Anyway, I'll let you know when these things become available. Oh, and I'll tell you, every lady I've shown this thing to and who's walked around with it a bit, she wants one for her sisters, her mother, her grandmother, every female in the family. Oh, and you want to know the number one question I get from ladies? What colors does it come in?
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos!